Okay, good morning, everyone.
Boker Tov.
We are on page 878. We're going to begin with the end of last week's Parsha as we blend into the beginning of this week's Parsha. Of course, at the last week's Parsha, so we know that Bilaam is unsuccessful to curse the Jewish people despite various efforts. We spoke a little bit about on Shabbos, about his intense passion for cursing the Jewish people. And once he realizes that, ooh, everyone, we move to the left. Our community is moving to the left. So once we, the sun, okay. So once Bilaam realizes that despite his most passionate effort to curse the Jewish people, he is unsuccessful, so he goes to plan B. And plan B is to seduce the Jewish people and to get them to doing the wrong thing. Figuring if he can get them to do the wrong thing, if they sin, then Hashem himself will do Bilaam's dirty work and will curse the Jewish people. And that is where we pick up at the beginning of the 25th chapter. Again, a very famous story in Tanakh that hopefully we will glean out details that were underappreciated up until this point. Says the Torah, Vayeshev Yisrael Bashitim Vayachel Aam Liznos Es Benos Moab. So Bashitim, Chazal tell us that it comes from the word Shtus, right? Shtus means a person doesn't sin unless Nichnas Bo Ruach Shtus. Yeah, stupidity is a bad word for it. It really means like foolishness, right? When you start doing foolishness, bad things happen. One of my favorite quotes, right? When I grew up, so my bubby used to, this is my bubby, we used to watch old films. So one of them was Music Man. Any Music Man fans here? So what's the greatest scene? My kids love it, right? He comes to, well, the parade is another good scene, but he comes to the town. He's sitting around the lamppost. And he tells everyone, we have trouble right here in River City. But what's the greatest quote from that entire song? The idol's brain is the devil's playground. Right? I think that's what he's talking. That's where he makes something like that. The idol brain is the devil's playground. Right. And his whole point is that when, right, that because remember there's a billiard, a pool store that opened up. And his whole point is that one day your kids are sitting around doing nothing, and the next day leads to mixed dancing. Literally, that's what it says in the song. That's not me, right? We take it a little bit differently. So anyways, that's exactly what happens. Vayeshev Yisrael Bashitim, they're sitting around, they're doing foolishness, and lo and behold, Vayachal Am Liznos Es Benos Moab. And all of a sudden, the Jewish people are being seduced into harlotry, into badness. Vatikrena la'am lezivchei Elohen, vayochal la'am v'yishtachavu la'elohem. And again, they call the people together. They are serving idolatry. Vayitzamed Yisrael le'baal pa'or. The Jewish people become very attached to Baal Pa'or. Vayichar af Adonai b'Yisrael. And Hashem becomes enraged against the Jewish people. Vayomar Adonai Moshe, kach es kol roshei ha'am, v'huka osam la'Adonai neged Hashemesh. Take all the people, hang everyone who was participating in this horrific action. Vayashav Charon Af Adonai Yisrael. And Hashem became pacified as a result of this action. Vayomer Moshe Shiftei Yisrael, Hirgu Ish Anashav Hanitzmadim LeBaal Peor. Kill off anyone that is connected to Baal Peor. And then, again, now, Pasuk 6, you have the very famous story of Zimri and Cosby, who are very publicly committing a very horrific act, right? Just to picture, the analogy of it would be the essentially going into Times Square, right? A very public, open spot. Everyone's walking around. All of a sudden, they're doing this horrific action. Vayar Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. Pinchas is seeing this. We've discussed in the past. Where's Moshe in this entire episode? Right? Moshe seems more passive now. Pinchas rises up. Vayakam mitoch haida vayikach romach biada. He takes a spear. Again, he kills Zimri and Cosby, and all of a sudden everyone dissipates. The whole plague disappears, and we're told 24,000 people pass away. We've spoken about in the past as well. 24,000, Chazal compare to the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva, and there's an entire significance there. Again, all this we've discussed in the past. All Pinchas up until this point was supposed to be the leader. That's why Moshe doesn't appoint a leader up until Parshas Pinchas. Because the assumption is that perhaps Pinchas was going to be the leader up until this point, when Moshe sees that Pinchas reacts the way that he does, yes, it's important for that moment in time, but no, that's not the type of leader that you want going forward. Right? You don't want what we'll call like that hothead, zealous type of leader to lead the Jewish people. You need someone who's going to be much more patient, and that's ultimately going to be Yoshua. You pick up at the beginning of Parshas Pinchas, and again, now Vayidaber Adonai Moshe Lemor, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron Kohen, Heshiva Schamasi ba'am b'nei Israel. So he has lessened my wrath against the Jewish people. Bikano es kinasi besocham. When he, again, I'm just translating art scroll now, when he zealously avenged my vengeance against them, okay, velo kilisi es b'nei Israel bikinasi, and I did not destroy the Jewish people in my rage. And then again, it tells us in Pasuk 16, Vayidaber Adonai Moshe Lemor, Tsaror es hamidyanim, that you are supposed to, right, you're supposed to, here it says harass, but you're supposed to, let's say, chase after the Midyanim, and you're supposed to hit them, Kitzorim heim lachem, because they did that to you, with Zimri and Cosby, al devar baal peor, about baal peor, and that's the end of the story. Okay? Now, the most fundamental question to me in this entire narrative is cause and effect. So we know that the result is Hashem gets angry at the Jewish people. What causes Hashem's anger at the Jewish people? Just by reading the very few psukim that you and I just read. Right? What causes Hashem's anger at the Jewish people? What was their sin that causes that? I just heard two different answers. So you said inappropriate behavior. What inappropriate behavior? You don't have to get too detailed. General. Right? We're all adults here. No. General, right? Znus. Okay, good. But someone in the back, I didn't hear who. Avodah Zarah. So already we have suggested two different reasons for what it is the Jewish people did wrong. Now, the reason why you guys are confused is because the psukim themselves lead us to be confused. So if you go back now to the end of Parshas Balak, the psukim are purposefully ambiguous. Okay? Again, chapter 25, verse 1. Vayeshev Yisrael Bashitim. Vayachel ha'am liznos es el benos Moab. Znus. Can't be more explicit than that. That the sin here is that they are engaged in harlotry, licentious behavior, promiscuity. Okay? The whole sin of Zimri and Cosby is one of promiscuity. So you're 100% right. I would argue, based on that, that the sin here is one of promiscuity. And yet, when you read Pasuk 2, what does the Pasuk say? Vatikrena la'am lezivche Elohen, that all of a sudden they call the people, la'am, the nation, lezivche Elohem, to the feast, right, to their sacrifices. Vayocha la'am v'yishtachavu le'elohem. What is this doing here? What does A and B have to do with each other? Pasuk Aleph is about promiscuity. Pasuk Bet is about idolatry. You don't really hear about the idolatry again until way later, when Hashem is kind of summarizing the entire narrative, and Hashem says, right, chase after the Midyanim. Why? Kitzorim heim lachem benich lehem, asher nichlu lachem, al devar peor, ve'al devar kazbi bat nasi, al devar peor. It almost sounds, in verse 18, that there's two things going on here. There's al devar baal, there's al devar peor. There's about peor. Peor is the idol. And there's al devar kazbi. And there's the thing of kazbi. Kazbi, we know already, is promiscuity. So what's al devar devar? I'm having a tongue twister moment here. Al devar peor must mean it's about idolatry. So it almost, the psukim almost leads you to believe that there are two sins going on here. Rashi says it's not really two sins. That really, one is the means and one is the end. Okay? We don't need to stretch our imaginations too far. But oftentimes, if you want to get a person to do something that they don't want to do, so various forms of promiscuity can be used towards that end. Okay? Spies have classically used that throughout history. You want to get information. You want to get someone in a compromised position where they're going to do what you want them to do. So you entice them you seduce him. That is exactly how Rashi reads our psukim. So for example, Rashi on 25, chapter 25, verse 2, Pasuk Beis, Rashi tells us, give me a second, here we go, says Rashi, Vayishtachavu le'elohem, kishetakaf Yitzro alav, they would seduce the men, and when the men's Yitzhara would be raging, the Omar la hashmi'i li, and he would say, right, let's cohabit together. V'hi motzia lo demus pa'or mecheka ve'omeris lo hishtachavu lazeh. So he would be in a compromised position. His Yitzhara would be raging at a million miles an hour, and she would say, give me 1 second. She'd reach into her pocket and say, first you have to bow down to his idol. Okay? And obviously the men in those compromised positions would bow down to the idol. So says Rashi, you're right. They're both going on here, but one's the means and one's the end. The means is seducing for the end of idolatry. Rashi says a very similar comment in Pasuk Yirchet, Pasuk 18. Again, Rashi is bothered by the exact same question. What is the real sin here? And Rashi says, Shehifgiru b'noseim liznus, that they would give over their daughters for promiscuity, kidei lahatoschem achar peor, so that the woman could then cause the men to bow down to peor. So again, Rashi here says one is the means and one is the end. One could very easily argue, as a second interpretation, that they're really commingled. In other words, the two aren't as mutually exclusive as we're talking about. When you talk about, and this is what I'll suggest as perhaps suggestion number two, and that comes from the Mishnah in Sanhedrin. The Mishnah in Sanhedrin tells us, who's this Peor? Right? We don't know who Peor is. Okay? In fact, if you look in, right, it says, Vayish, Vayitzamed Yisrael Lebal Peor. The Jewish people are very, very connected to Peor. Why tell us the name of the idolatry? Right? Is it important? Is it not important? Could we have gotten away without it? Story probably could have gone on had we not told you the name of Peor. So the Mishnah in Sanhedrin tells us that there's something unique about Peor. Says the Mishnah, HaPoer Atzmo Lebal Peor Zohi Avodaso. Hey, the Mishnah is describing various forms of prohibited idolatry. And one of the types of idolatry that the Mishnah describes is Peor. And the Mishnah tells us, HaPoer Atzmo Lebal Peor. Poer Atzmo means one who defecates in front of Peor.
Oh, really?
Defecates. HaPoer Atzmo Lebal Peor Zohi Avodaso. That is the way that you served Peor. Okay? So apparently, the way in which you served this idol called Peor is by relieving yourself in front of Peor. Now, if that's the case, that definitely makes you read our Parsha a little bit differently. Okay? Because what it means is, Vayishav Yisrael Bashitim, they're doing promiscuity. Then, all of a sudden, Pasuk Bet is they are relieving themselves in front of Peor as a form of idolatry. And the word here is Vayitzamed Yisrael Lebal Peor. They like felt connected to that. There was some attraction. There was something appealing about that. Now, I'm about to go on a road trip with my children. Okay, so this is your last week with me. Rabbi Goldberg will be back next week. Part of the road trip is, one of the difficulties, is kids need to go to the bathroom, right? And as the saying goes, a man's got to go when a man's got to go. So sometimes that means that my children will relieve themselves on the side of a highway. That's just how it goes. Maybe I'm a good dad, bad dad. You'll all get over it, right? Okay, when you're driving 22 hours with three rambunctious children, anything goes, okay? So something about, right, the Mishnah, HaPoer Atzmo Lebal Peor, you relieve yourself to Peor, Zohi Avodaso. That is the way you serve Peor. What a strange way to serve an idol. What a strange thing to be attracted to as a form of idolatry, right? We can't appreciate idolatry because we don't live in a world of idolatry. But the Gemaras already tell us that the draw of idolatry was magnetic. It was extremely strong, right? The way you and I are attached to our cell phones, that's the way they were attracted to idolatry. And yet it's so unfathomable for us that they would be attracted to a form of idolatry that required you to relieve yourself in front of the idolatry, almost like in a public fashion. Okay? So what is it? Which sin is it? We kind of have like two questions going on here at once. Number one, what sin are we talking about? Promiscuity? Or are we talking about idolatry? Question number two is, what was so appealing about this form of idolatry that the Jewish people felt so connected to it? And here's my suggestion. That what was so attractive about the idolatry of Peor is that it was a philosophy of doing whatever you want, whenever you want, and however you want, basically. That whatever feels natural to you, whatever feels good to you, so you are able to go ahead and do it. And what you never have to tell yourself is one magical word. No. You never have to tell yourself no. So which one is it? Did the Jewish people sin in promiscuity, or did the Jewish people sin with idolatry? The answer is, it doesn't matter. Because at their root, the same philosophy underlies both of those sins, which is no restrictions, no rules, no limitations, and no self-control required. Right? So think about sexual immorality. Right? We're up to Woodstock 50. I wasn't there. Maybe 60? No. There's some anniversary. 50? No. There's some anniversary. I don't know. Everyone's talking about... It's Woodstock 60? 50? So what? How many years? Okay, whatever. You guys will figure it out. There's some anniversary this summer of Woodstock. 50 years. Good. There's some anniversary this year of Woodstock. So that was basically, again, I wasn't there. Maybe some of you were. But that's the feeling I get. Just this, like, everything goes type of mentality. Okay? That's exactly what we're talking about here. So both crimes have the exact same root philosophy, which says everything says yes, everything is permissible, and nothing is a no. And there's something very attractive to that. So what does it mean that the Jewish people were attached to the idolatry of Peor? It doesn't mean necessarily that they were attracted to the form of worship of Peor, but they were attracted to this philosophy, which said there are no rules, there are no restrictions. You never have to tell yourself no. There's no limitations you have to place on yourself. Anything you want to do, you're allowed to do. Now, obviously, this is catastrophic to a religious perspective, where specifically limitations are placed on what we are allowed to do and what we're not allowed to do. That was the entire giving of the Torah. And therefore, now you see why Baal Peor was so destructive, why Hashem reacted in the way that he did. Not just because it was idolatry. Idolatry is bad, don't get me wrong. And not just because it was promiscuity. That's bad too. But it's the philosophy. It's the root philosophy of both of them, which says that everything is a yes and nothing is a no. Now we know that this is catastrophic from a religious perspective. And we know that from the Torah itself. Because the Torah, all the way back in Sefer Shmos, right before Har Sinai, the Torah does something very funny, which is the following. All the way back in Parshas Yisro. You don't have to turn. I'll read for you. Vayisu me Rifidim. The Jewish people leave Rifidim. Vayavo midbar Sinai. Vayachanu mabin bar. They settle in the desert. Vayichan sham Yisrael neged ahar. And they hold themselves opposite the mount. When the Torah goes on to describe the mountain, there is one phrase that comes up over and over and over again. And that is the word gvul. For example, gvul, which means a border. For example, in Pasuk Yidbet over there, vihigbalta es ha'am saviv, and you should set boundaries for the people around it. Okay? They are allowed to come close, but they're not allowed to go all the way up. Right? The word gvul, or various forms of it, appear countless times surrounding the story of Har Sinai. Okay? So for example, Vayomer Alaam Hayu Nechonim L'Shloshes Yamim Al Tikshu Elisha. You're living there for 3 days. You can't be with your wife. There's a restriction. There's a limitation. And I can give you other examples as well. Why? What's the purpose of highlighting that by Har Sinai? Right? Har Sinai is about receiving the Torah. Why all of a sudden are you referencing over and over and over again this notion of boundaries and gvul? The answer is that's the whole purpose of Har Sinai. The whole purpose of Har Sinai, the whole halachic system that you and I are engaged in, is a system where not everything is a yes, but some things are a no, right? Boundaries and restrictions really form the foundation of a religious lifestyle. Hey, we see this elsewhere, and we've spoken about this in the past, the Rambam. When the Rambam talks about his Hilchos Kedusha, his laws of holiness, what does the Rambam put in his Hilchos Kedusha? So what would I put in the laws of holiness? Maybe Tefillah, maybe Talmud Torah, maybe laws of meditation, I don't know, whatever the case might be. What does the Rambam put in his laws of Kedusha, of holiness? He puts in Hilchos Isurei Bia, laws of sexual morality, and Machalos Asuros, what you are allowed to eat and what you're not allowed to eat. What is the commonality between those two areas of halacha? They're both areas where my animalistic instinct tells me to do one thing, and Judaism comes along and says that there are restrictions, there are limitations on what you are allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. That, says the Torah, is what's Kedusha. Holiness in Judaism is specifically in those areas where we form boundaries, where we form restrictions around ourselves. So the Torah comes, the Rambam comes along and says, you want to know how to be holy? Doesn't just mean everything, anytime, under no restrictions, no limitations, no self-control required. No, it's specifically in your ability to manifest self-control, that is where Kedusha is found. Okay? And that is what Baal Peor stood as the antithesis of. Baal Peor comes along and says, anything goes. And therefore, is it one sin or is it two sins? The answer is, it's irrelevant. It's one root philosophy. It's one foundational concept which says, I can do anything, anytime, anywhere. I want to go to the bathroom? Here's a good place to go to the bathroom. I want to cohabit with that woman? I could do that too. And nobody's going to tell me anyways. And that's why Hashem reacts the way that he did. Now, we know this to be true, not only religiously, but we know this to be true psychologically as well. That there's something enormously empowering about telling yourself no. I want to share with you two studies which highlight this point, and I think will give you a lot of food for thought, but it's exactly what we're talking about right here. Okay? Researchers conducted the following study. They divided 120 participants into two groups. One group told themselves, I can't. The other group told themselves, I don't. So in this particular case, they tempted the 120 participants with candy. Okay, now, this might come as a surprise for you. Candy doesn't do it for me, but maybe some of you. So let's say, I don't know, chocolate, Dunkin' Donuts, I don't know, whatever it is that does it for you. Let's say candy bars, okay? So they put, what is a good candy? Snickers. Okay, so they put Snickers bars in front of everyone, I don't know, okay? Half the group, so 60 of the participants, have to tell themselves, I can't eat that candy bar. The other 60 say, I don't eat that candy bar. They did this for a little while. They practiced it. They rehearsed it. And then at some point, the participants were told that the study had ended and they can go. They were free to go. And as they were going out, on the way out, there was a table set up with snacks. And half of the snacks were Snicker bar. Not Snicker, but like unhealthy snacks. And the other half was, you know, like the healthy trail mix that no one eats and leaves over, okay? And what they found was the following. That of the 60, of the group that was told to say, I cannot, 61% ate the unhealthy candy right as they were leaving. And of the group that told themselves, I don't, only 36% ate the unhealthy candy and the rest made healthier choices, okay? Study number two. Very similar scenario. They took a group of women and they brought them to a health and wellness seminar, talking about getting into shape, having good health. Half of the group had to tell themselves throughout the entire duration of their stay there, I can't miss a workout today. The other half of the group, exactly the same, told themselves that I don't miss a workout. Okay? And what they found is that during the course of the study, that the I can't group had only 10% of its participants persist with their health goals. And of the group number two that says I don't, an incredible 80% persisted in achieving their goal. Now, what do you see from all this, other than it's just cute studies? Telling yourself I can't is an expression of what? It's an expression of your limitations, right? It's a terminology that says, I really want to do something, but I'm going to force myself not to do it, right? It's my limitation. I'm limited in what I can do. Telling myself I don't, or in our purposes, for the sake of this class, telling yourself no, right, is not an expression of your own limitations, but it's an expression of self-control. It's saying that I am in control of myself. I don't do this. That is not a limitation that's imposed on me by someone else. That is something that I have decided and that I have the power in my situation to control. So whereas one is an expression of almost weakness and limitations imposed externally, the other is an expression of empowerment and self-control that is expressed internally. That's the difference between saying, I cannot do something, which means someone is forcing me essentially to say that, versus I don't, which is a choice that I myself make. In the studies, both studies that I showed, show clearly that when someone says I can't, so they'll do it on a short-term basis. They'll listen for the short term, but the second they have a chance to cut out, they're at it. Someone who tells themselves, I don't do this, they now feel empowered to make smart decisions. They now feel that they are in control. They have the power over their own situation. And therefore, when it's no longer imposed on them, they have built up a reservoir of self-control to be able to tackle any situation that's put in their way. So we see that being able to tell yourself no isn't just a religious value. As the Rambam describes in his Hilchos Kedusha, that being holy means the ability to manifest a sense of self-control. But it actually helps you in the long run, whatever goals and aspirations you want. Being able to tell yourself no, building up that muscle memory actually helps you far better in the long run. Yeah. Yeah, the marshmallow study. But that already is, they've attempted to disprove that, so I didn't go there. But yeah, the marshmallow study also. Kids who are able to display a sense of willpower ultimately do better. Let me share with you a crazy source that I think drives this all home. This is from a sefer called B'nai Machshava Tova. B'nai Machshava Tova is written by the Pia Zetzner Rebbe, the Eish Kodesh, who we famously know wrote a sefer called Chovas HaTalmidim. He was the Rav of the Warsaw Ghetto. We've given many classes about him in the past. So B'nai Machshava Tova is basically a cohort, a small cohort of growth-minded people that he collected together, and you know, it was more of like a community of learners. Less preachy and more like, what are we working on? How are we going to grow? So in the context of that, and it's not the easiest of his Sfarim to get through, but in many respects, a very practical book to get through. And in there, he says the following. He's talking about exactly what we're talking about. The ability to display a sense of self-control. And he says the following. Tinase kipam bipam bidvarim kalierech. Sometimes, take something very trivial and focus on that. L'mashal, as an example. Lishtot lifamim coffee below tsukar. In other words, sometimes drink your coffee without sugar. Now, that's obviously an absurd example, he says. But what are you doing that? He says, you might laugh at that. But, aval bekali erech, elu, tucha lamod gam bekishrei milchama gdola, shunege nafshecha v'nishmascha. Train yourself in self-control with silly, simple, trivial things, so that when you are faced with a much more consequential example of where you need to manifest self-control, you'll be ready and you'll build up that muscle memory to be able to do that. And then he gives another example. Etaklal hazet tishmor. Right? Like, listen up. This is really important, he says. Lechem achol lesova, we all eat bread. Aval dvarim haravim lechech levad. Tashay bedin akol liiso liisa. So he says, im yesh lefanecha shnei mine basar. Let's say they bring out the platter of meat or chicken at your Shabbos table. And one of those pieces of meat looks like amazing. And the other one looks like it was overcooked. Okay, sometimes people do that. They, like the middle section is a little bit more rare and the ends are a little bit more, you know, cooked. So whichever one is more appealing to you, okay? So whichever piece is the juicier piece. And you're like, your initial reaction is to grab that piece like a pack of wild dogs. Even if you don't even want one piece over another, but your like eye catches that piece. You know, in the movies, like when they're running through the fields and it's like the music slows and they're like running slowly at each other. That's like you and this piece of meat. You guys are destined for each other. Okay? At that moment, he says, stop yourself. In picture, ki cherev chadamuneches apazer zeh. Right, he's playing on a play of words of a Gemara. But like, picture that there's now a cage surrounding that piece of meat. Hishamer vehechirko. And you have to stay away from that piece of meat. Vechenim bechlal ohe basarata. And even more so, if you actually want that piece of meat. Why? Why is all this important? You're probably wondering, Moskowitz has lost his mind. What's he talking about? He says, "Eini omer lecha shelo tocha basar legamre." I'm not telling you not to eat meat. He says, "Rak harbei pamim omer lecha la'atzmacha." What is the important thing that you say to yourself? And this is the key line: "Moshel ani al atzmi." I'm in control of myself. The meat is not in control of me. The chocolate cake is not in control of me. I am in control of myself. That, he says, again, it's not a very long book. And I just read for you part of it, right? He emphasizes this notion because what greater capacity for a Jew to have than the ability to manifest that self, that sense of self-control, right? Moshel ani al atzmi. I am in control. I don't do that. It's not that I can't. I have free will, but I don't do that. I am choosing. I am in control. It is under my power. And therefore, I'm empowered to do the right thing. Therefore, says B'nai Machshava Tova, says the Holy Piyazetzner Rebbe, that's an important component for us to have. Now, why? Who cares? The meat, the coffee, who cares? The answer is, we don't care. But if you can't ever tell yourself no, then Judaism is going to be a lot harder for you. If you built up the capacity for self-control and self-restraint, then you'll be much more successful in Judaism. You'll have much more of a Har Sinai mentality than you will a Baal Peor mentality. Dr. Pelkowitz told me a great story a number of years ago, where he said he was giving a class at a prominent school in Manhattan. I'll leave the name out. But he finished a whole class on parenting. And part of what he discussed on parenting is teaching your child how to say no and accept no, right? I want this, I want that. No, right? We all know that as a parent, that's the hardest thing to do. Because then what happens after the word no? First they go to the other parent, yeah. Right? And then after they go to the other parent, then they come back and then the hissy fit, they're crying, they hate you, hate me, all my friends have it, you're right? Okay, so no parent wants to be in that situation. That's the worst. So he's giving this whole lecture about how to tell your child no, how to parent, and a father comes up to him afterwards, complete sincerity, and says to him, how am I supposed to teach my son to say no when I can't say no to myself? Right? Can't say no to myself. And we know people like that. We know people like that, whether it's with shopping, whether it's with eating, whether it's, you know, even in a not clinical way. Just they like saying yes to themselves. Okay? Saying no to yourself is an incredible capacity. It's an important muscle for us to have. And it doesn't come out of nowhere. It requires, the same way a muscle requires a workout to build it up, so this requires the exact same workout. And that's why the Piyazetsna Rebbe says that we work on small things. That I'm not going to eat that piece, I'm going to eat that piece. You know why? Because that shows me that I have the capacity to tell myself no. Rabbi Soloveitchik makes this exact same point in an article. Rabbi Soloveitchik says the following. He says, we must recognize that there are two forms of heroism. One kind is the spectacular and glorious heroism, of which minstrels sing on street corners and trabadors recite in the marketplace. The heroism consists of bold, dramatic actions, of publicly defying evil and injustice, of being ready to suffer and accept martyrdom as a consequence. What I would call Pinchas. That's what Pinchas does in this week's parsha. It's bold, it's dramatic, made the front pages of the New York Times. Okay? But, he says, the other kind of heroism is non-spectacular and has produced historically meager results. The decisions are insignificant except for the party involved. There's another form of heroism where nobody knows about and nobody finds out about. This heroism consists primarily of giving up something very precious at the moment of achieving the highest joy. It's the heroism of giving up something that you really want badly. It occurs unnoticed by others in private chambers and in the solitude of mind. Judaism recognizes both kinds of heroism. We're going to talk about on Tisha B'Av, the 10 martyrs, the Asar Hurugei Malchus. That is public heroism. The second kind of heroism is known only to God. Only He is aware of it, and only He can appreciate it. The second type of heroism is when nobody's looking, when nobody's around, when you really want to do something, and you tell yourself no. Right? Looking at something, watching something, eating something. You're not getting Mafta Yona for that. You're not going to be put on the front pages of the New York Times. You're not going to make it into some rabbi's drusha as some heroic act. But that, says the Rav, is equal, if not more, of a form of heroism. What's the heroism that he's talking about? It's our heroism. It's called self-control. It's called restraint. When we tell ourselves no, in that moment where I want something, I know it might be wrong, but no one's looking, but I'm going to do it anyways, but when you're getting tugged and pulled in both directions, and you're able to tell yourself no, that, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, is a great form of heroism. He gives the example, he says that's why when the Beis HaMikdash was being destroyed, and Yirmiyahu, the Medrash famously tells us, is going around trying to get support from our Avos and Imos to stop Hashem. And he goes to Avram, and he goes to Yitzchak, and he goes to and he goes to all the Avos, and he says, can you plead to Hashem on behalf? They all go plead to Hashem, and Hashem rejects them all. Who, of course, does he listen to? Rachel. Right, Rachel. Rachel mevakal baneha. Why does he listen to Rachel and not Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov? I don't know that that would have been the intuitive decision that you and I would have made. So what is it about Rachel? Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, what was Rachel's form of heroism? She gave up her night with Yaakov to her sister. She switched the signs. Anyone know about that? Did anyone find out about that? Right? I mean, we do because it's put in the Torah. But at the time, that was a very secretive form of heroism. She didn't do it because she thought she was going to get Mafta Yona. Now, she wouldn't have gotten Mafta Yona for other reasons, but she didn't do it because she thought she was going to get Mafta Yona. She, in the innermost chambers, when no one else was looking, did the right thing. And therefore, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, he says, no one watches the young couple on a date. It is simple to violate the law, especially if one is driven by an urge which is basically animalistic. Self-control at such a moment is very much appreciated by Hashem. Right? That's heroism. When we talk about heroism, we think about it in big terms. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, no. A minor, small expression of self-control at the right time when you're tempted and have an urge to do the wrong thing because your animalistic instinct tells you to do it, and you stop yourself at that moment, that self-control is kedusha. That's holiness. That self-control is exactly what Hashem demands of us. That's halacha. That's Judaism. That's v'igbalta esahar. That's why Hashem emphasizes the notion of barriers and boundaries around Har Sinai, because that's what Har Sinai is. if not boundaries and restrictions in our lives. And so oftentimes you'll hear someone saying, does halacha really care if I do X? Does halacha really care if I do Y? So maybe, maybe not. But it's creating a system. It's creating a system of discipline which trains us to overcome that animalistic side of ourselves, what the Baal HaTanya would call our nefesh habahamis, our animalistic, our soul, and to elevate it to what the Baal HaTanya calls our nefesh elokis, or our chelek eloka mimal, the elevated part of ourselves, the transcendent parts of ourselves. That's what differentiates ourselves. Says the Baal HaTanya, everyone has a nefesh habahamis. Everyone has a soul of an animal. But it takes a very special Jew to be able to elevate that into a nefesh elokis, to be able to tap into that chelek eloka mimal, to tap into that godly soul that each one of us have the potential to manifest. And it starts, says the B'nai Machshava Tova, with something as simple as not taking piece of meat A, but taking piece of meat B. The last point I want to make today comes back to the Parsha. And that is that there's one word in the Parsha which I think summarizes a lot of what we are saying. And that is as follows. How do you translate the word kin'ah? So all of you translated it as jealousy. Now this word appears many times in the Torah that we are reading here this week. So for example, the Pasuk says, when he says that you should take, that he's giving Pinchas the bris kunah, he says, Bikano es kinasi bisocham, because you are jealous of my jealousy in them, and I didn't destroy the Jewish people in my jealousy. Now, the reason why most of us think it means jealousy is because that's the way it's used in Sefer Bereishis. So all the way back in Sefer Bereishis, when Leah is popping out babies left and right, and Rachel is not, so the Torah tells us in the beginning of chapter 30, Vateir Rachel ki lo yalda liYaakov, Vatikane Rachel bachosa. Rachel becomes jealous of her sister. We know this also from Pirkei Avos, where we say, Hakina ve'ataiva ve'akavod motzienes adamin olam. Kina there is a direct, I think we most of us assume it means jealousy. That's one. How else can you translate kina? So Rashi translates kina a little bit differently in our Parsha. Rashi says it's not jealousy. What else, what is it? Binikmo es nikmasi, bikatzpo es haketzef shayelo likso. Kolashon kina, hi ha mitchare linikom nikmat davar. What is kina, says Rashi? It's not jealousy. Revenge, vengeance. It's vengeance out of anger. It's like a fury. It's a zealousness, like you're, like someone does something to you, and you know, you like feel anatomically and like you feel yourself changing, right? I get it, my shoulders first, that's where I start feeling that. And then your body tenses up and you're like ready to react, and you know you shouldn't, but you should, right? So like I learned already, never send emails on fast days. Right? I never press send. I wait until the next day and then I press send when I'm thinking a little clearer and I'm less grouchy. Right? So we all know that feeling. That's what Rashi's saying. In other words, it's like this zealous revenge. And that reads, I think, a little bit more clearly into the pasuk. Right? Heshives chamasi me'al b'nei Israel, bikano es kinasi b'socham. You took vengeance on behalf of me. Right? Velo kilizi es b'nei Israel, bikinasi. And I didn't destroy the people, bikinasi, in my rage, almost. Now, lest you think that's it's wrong to refer to Hashem as a raging Hashem or a wrathful Hashem. Hashem himself says that in the Ten Commandments, calls himself El Kano. Right? Doesn't mean he's a jealous God. It means he's a vengeful God over there. So it could be jealousy. It could be a sense of vengefulness. And yet, there's one other place where this word kin'ah appears many, many times and really is the epicenter of the entire storyline. And what other story in Tanakh is that? Don't all scream it out at once. story of the Sota. Story of the Sota, all the way back in Parshas Naso, where the story tells us, Ve'avar alav ruach kina, that this ruach kina, the spirit of kina, overcomes the guy, v'kinei es ishto, and he is kinei, his wife. And again, that word comes up over and over again. So what are we talking about here? Right, what are we talking about here? Right, what are we talking about here? What does the word kina mean in that example? So it could mean jealousy. Is the husband really jealous of his wife? Is the husband really jealous of the adulterous man at that point? I don't know that jealousy is exactly the word that I would use. Right? Is he infuriated? Vengeful? So you could translate it as that. But what happened, if he was vengeful, what would he have done at that moment in time? He would have killed her. Right? What doesn't he do? It's a very methodical process. He takes her to the Beis HaMikdash. There's a whole drawn-out process. You almost like get the sense that you're drawing it out a little bit. So it's not exactly vengefulness. Kina, rather, means the following. It's the mindset that appears in a person when they have an expectation of exclusivity. Right? That is how I think a better definition of kina is. In the story of Sota, it's not just rage. It's not just anger. But it's anger that comes out of an expectation that I was in an exclusive relationship, and now all of a sudden, my wife is with another man. That's the root of where that rage comes from. Now let's take that same definition of kina and apply it in our parsha. Right? The Jewish people are serving idolatry. And Hashem says, "Bekano es kinasi besocham." Why would Hashem specifically use this word of kina? Because what, right, you know, the SAT is like, this is to that, as that is to this, right? So in this is how I would put it, that adultery is to a marriage as idolatry is to monotheism, right? Adultery is to marriage as idolatry is to monotheism. The same way, when you're in a monogamous relationship, so you have an assumption that it's me, it's you, and it's only us. And when someone breaks that bond, when they break that exclusivity, there's that feeling of kina. We learned that by the story of Sota. So too, we and Hashem are engaged in an exclusive relationship. There's us, and there's Hashem. And the second we break that bond of exclusivity, Hashem feels that sense of kina. Now, I think that's a beautiful idea in general, right? But what's even more is it's showing us that kina by the Sota and kina in our relationship with Hashem require complete, unadulterated dedication. It means there's us, there's Hashem, and there's no one else. There's me, there's my spouse, and there's no one else. It's that level of restraint, self-control, sense of boundaries. That's exactly what we're talking about here. That's the whole story of Pinchas. The whole story of Baal Peor is a story of kina. Are we able to tell Hashem, I am in an exclusive relationship with you, absent anyone else? And if we can tell Hashem that, then we have maintained exactly what we were able to achieve at Har Sinai, which is a sense of boundaries. And if that's the case, then this story of Baal Peor isn't just a nice story, but what is it? What is it? It's a second Har Sinai. Right? Har Sinai happened to the first generation that left Mitzrayim. This generation is a new generation. Right? They were not at Har Sinai. This becomes thematically, philosophically, theologically, the exact same experience as Har Sinai, which is saying, are you able to enter into a relationship with me that is exclusive of everyone else? Are you able to manifest that self-control, that restraint, that telling yourself no? And if you are, that's Har Sinai, that's receiving the Torah, then you're successful. If you're not, then I'm going to wipe you out because you clearly didn't learn the lessons that I've been trying to show you the entire time. The entire essence of Judaism is our ability to say no to ourselves. That was Har Sinai, that was Baal Peor, and here's the best part. That's the Haftorah. Now, it's not really the Haftorah, because we don't read this Haftorah most years. When Parshas Pinchas happens after, Shavas Batamas, so we know that there are special Haftorahs that we read in the lead up to Tisha B'Av. It's called, right there, seven Haftorahs, which means that there are 7 weeks until, I won't scare all of you. Okay, but the real Haftorah for Parshas Pinchas is what story? It's the story of Eliyahu. Right? Now, the story of Eliyahu is after what episode? Right? What's it connected to? The Jewish people are once again doing idolatry. And Eliyahu comes to Hashem, and what does he tell him? Right? He finds himself in a cave for 40 days. That sounds really interesting. 40 days in a cave. Right? We know someone who did that before. And what does he say? Vayomer, kano kinesi ladonai Elohei Tzvaot. I was not jealous. It means that the Jewish people are serving idolatry. Eliyahu is trying to preserve what? Why does he use that word, kano kinesi, the same exact word that's used in our parsha? Because what he's telling Hashem is, I was trying to preserve that exclusive relationship between you and the Jewish people. Why? Ki azvu brischa b'nei Yisrael. Es mizbecho secha harasu. Ves neviecha haragu b'charev. V'ivater ani levadi v'ivakshua nafshi l'kachta. Right? What is Eliyahu? Kano es kinasi. What is he jealous? Well, again, what we're colloquially referring to jealous of. But why is that word used? Ki azvu brischa b'nei Yisrael. Because the Jewish people had abandoned the covenant. Right? Es mizbecho secha harasu. They destroyed your altars, right? Your altars, your mizbeach, the form that we use to connect to Hashem. The Jewish people, what did that mean that they abandoned them? They didn't give up on worship. They just worshiped not only one person, they worshiped lots of people. And then again, Hashem says, Malacha po Eliyahu. And Eliyahu says, Kano kinesi. And Hashem says, hold on. And that's the very famous, Kol dmama daka, right? That the small, still voice. Why does Hashem say the small, still voice, the quiet voice? Why is that the end of this entire conversation? So the answer is, the Rav's two forms of heroism. That there's one form of heroism, which is the Pinchas form of heroism. Loud, big lights, Times Square, front page of the New York Times. Is Pinchas appointed as the leader of the people? No, because that's not sustainable. What's the second form of heroism that the Rav described? The quiet one. The one when no one's paying attention. That's what Hashem is communicating to Eliyahu when he says, Kol dmama daka. You want to be a leader? You want to show the Jewish people how to be a hero? Sometimes it happens in those small moments. It's what the Rav had called he had some pretty way of saying it, right? Non-spectacular, historically meager results. It's insignificant except for the party involved. And when Eliyahu does not learn that lesson, if again, you got to read the Haftorah a little carefully. I don't want to get into it all now. But Hashem says, Malacha po, and he keeps on saying, Kano kinesi. And Hashem says, you're missing the point. I'm not in the thunder, and I'm not in the lightning, and I'm not in the big stuff. I'm in the kol dmama daka. And what happens right after that? After that conversation, Elisha comes onto the scene, and Eliyahu basically disappears. When Eliyahu can't extract himself from that Pinchas mindset, same way in our parsha, when Pinchas is Pinchas, Hashem says we need a Yoshua. In the Haftorah, when Eliyahu is Eliyahu, Hashem says we need an Elisha. Okay, so it's comparable, and it's reliving the story of Har Sinai as well—the 40 days, the cave, the alone. It's all the same story. It's all the same narrative. But what's it a narrative of? It's a narrative of what it means to be Hashem's people. To be Hashem's people means being able to manifest that self of restraint, that sense of self-control, the ability to say no to ourselves. We saw it at Har Sinai. That's the Gvul. We see it here by Baal Peor. Why was Baal Peor so destructive philosophically? Because it was a mindset of no limitations, no restrictions, everything is a yes, no self-control. We saw that that's the word kano, kinesi, that kina doesn't just mean jealousy, doesn't just mean vengeance. It means all of that in the context of when I expected exclusivity, And I was unable to sustain that because I wanted to be everything to everyone, anywhere. That's when the Torah employs the word kin'ah to show that no, to be in a relationship means to be exclusive. Me to the exclusion of everybody else. Which means saying no to things. And being able to manifest self-restraint and self-control. And that's exactly what Eliyahu in the Haftorah deals with. Kano kinesi, Eliyahu says, Hashem, I'm trying to preserve that exclusivity of the relationship. Hashem says, that's great, you can do that. But it's not going to happen in the heroism, number one, that the Rav described, which was the big, you know, bold, dramatic actions, but it's going to come in the cold mamadaka. When Eliyahu can't appreciate that, the same way Pinchas couldn't appreciate that, there needs to be a new leader for the people. That's Yehoshua, and that is Elisha. So I tried to stream together a few different storylines of Har Sinai, of Baal Peor, of the Haftorah, again, that we're not going to read, but it is the Haftorah of Eliyahu in the desert with Hashem, to show us that a halachic system, at its core, is the ability to tell yourself no. Why is that so important? It's so important because that's Kedusha. That's what enables us to elevate our animalistic instinct into a godlike instinct. And ultimately, that's the level of holiness. That's the level of Kedusha that Hashem demands.